The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm happy you have joined me on this Saturday afternoon, March 2nd, 2013. I want to acknowledge donations from Bob from Illinois, Carl, Teresa, Dimitar from Canada, Richard and Art, and just yesterday, Paul from California. Thanks to you all. What you do in helping us financially is very important. I also hope that you will enjoy the George Lincoln Rockwell streaming audio this month that Tan has gotten started yesterday. And it will be going whenever there's not a program playing or the repeats of the program for 24 hours or so after it. Then in the meantime, we have this streaming audio now. We've had music, but now we've got the George Lincoln Rockwell speeches from Texas in a long talk, and not speeches. It was actually a talk in a private home that went on for over 2 hours, I think it was, in 1965. And I like having these audio things, and I hope we'll have some more like this. If they can be found. So hope you will enjoy that. And my tentatively scheduled guest for today was Charles Kraft, which I did mention a few times before today, but he's unable to make it due to just arriving back from an extended trip to India and needing to reorient himself a bit first, which I was a little bit skeptical whether he could, managed to come on so soon, right after he arrived back from this long trip. And he also caught a bug while he was in Bombay. And I hope he's back now. But as most of you probably know, Charles Kraft is a well-known artist who has been under a lot of attack by the ultra-liberal left who dominate the art business, no matter where it is, on the East Coast, West Coast, North, South, everywhere in the world. This is an area that the Jews went into strongly, art, just as soon as they received their infamous emancipation in Europe. This is one of the areas they went into real big and have also managed to dominate. So last Monday on the Heretics Hour with Tan Staffel, I had actually already been sent an email from Charles telling me this, that he had to postpone his coming on the program. But I didn't receive it because it was sent to a faulty address. And so at that time, I still thought he was coming on, and I mentioned it. But so that's why I did mention it then, because I hadn't gotten that, but he did send it. And so now, Charles is very interested in the truth movement and in a lot of the things that we discuss, and he's been three times on one of my programs. First time when I was still with Voice of Reason, the other two times, I believe it's been on the White Network, but I've known him for quite a while, and he's a most enjoyable person, and he has been, under attack recently, because his interest in these subjects has been discovered by his so-called friends in the art world. His art, if you don't, I should have linked his art, but you you have to just, there's a website called charleskraft.com. Charleskraft.com, and you can go there and find his art. But he's been very, very successful with it. He works hard at it. He works in ceramics a lot. And I've talked about it before. So I'm not going to do that right now. We'll talk about it when he does come on. But the thing is that after I found out that he wouldn't be on today, I started looking up all these looking at all these other sites that were had picked up this first article exposing his affiliation with white nationalism and Holocaust denial. And I read those too. And you know how it is when you start searching around, one thing led to another. And I found out some things that I thought, gee, I think I'll do my own expose on some of these art figures today, at least in, you know, I'm doing it in the first hour. And in the second hour, Harlan Schulke is going to be coming on, and we're going to talk about Sandy Hook. So I'm going to have to get what I have to say here in this hour. So, which I think I can do. And, you know, the people who are so shocked by discovering the real Charles Kraft and have been writing about it in several places, you know, it's amazing that they're shocked because reality shocks them since they live in a bubble where their version of history and what counts is all they ever acknowledge. I mean, and they are tied in with the political correct view of things in which that is all the only way that anybody can possibly see things. Otherwise, you're some kind of a kook or you're someone that, you know, they use a bad name for. You shouldn't even be listened to or paid attention to. And this is what's going on now with Charles. You know, this morning when I first turned on the internet, I was just running down real quickly down the news stories. And there was this article I saw that intrigued me about Kanye West's house being on the market, his off the market house back on the market. And it showed a photograph of the interior. And it had these strange cartoon-like pictures on the wall as artwork-like. And I thought, I have to look at this. So I did, and I found it. In fact, I've got it up here. I found it so strange. He's got an ultra-modern, supposed to be $3 million home. You know, Kanye West, I never pay attention to him, but it takes me a long time to figure out who these people are. But he's a rapper. He's black. And he's in a relationship with Kim Kardashian. In fact, she's now carrying his baby. And she's not white, but she's not black. But anyway, that's you know, he's supposed to be such a great sex figure or something in the celebrity world because he makes so much money. And anyway, this $3.3 million house, it's selling for that. And they showed some pictures of the interior, one of the exterior. What got me, you see, because I'm going to be talking about art today, is this, what is on the walls? Now, I'm sure somebody designed, you know, an interior designer did this whole thing. I doubt, but they, you know, probably said what he liked. Well, there, in this one picture, there's, it's on Yahoo News. There's three large pictures, pieces of something on the wall hanging like paintings, but they're not. I don't know what they're made of. Maybe plastic or something, but they're cartoon figures from some well-known. Fred Flintstone is one, Mrs. Flintstone, and a dog with his tongue out, big cartoon dog, and this little blonde kid. I can't even think of what he's from. And this is what's decorating the walls of this ultra-modern home. And there's over in the corner is a bunch of stuffed animals, like for kids. Well, I don't think he has any kids. This is for him. This is what he likes. You know, you're talking about the mentality of a grade school child or younger even. And in his, they have a photograph of his bedroom, of a bedroom here. And, you can, if you go down past the last one, there's in the corner, there's a bar there, you know, and all this stuff. And then, in the corner, there's this bright colored chair, like things are in primary colors. The house is very muted, but these artworks are all in primary colors because they're all cartoon figures. And there's some cartoony stuffed animals. I don't know if that's what the chair is or if they're next to the chair. But what really got me was on the right side of this photograph is a tall, probably larger than life-size, three-dimensional figure of this cartoon character that I couldn't find him. I don't remember what he's called. He was an astronaut. I don't know if he's Disney or some other animation company. He was that astronaut or space commander or something with a real big long chin, dressed in his cartoony space commander outfit. And that's like a sculpture, you know, that's there as a sculpture standing there. It was just amazing that this man's house is full of these cartoon things for art. You know, I mean, there's a couple of large screen type print paintings. I can't tell what they are. Maybe they have some personal reference to him set to himself and his career, but mostly it's just so here you go. You know, these great heroes of the liberals, you know, that they're so busy, you know, approving of and so on, have the taste of children, and this is what the art world just plays off to. This, of course, he doesn't even have pop art there. He's got real solid, real cartoons, just cartoons, like straight out of the comic book or the newspaper, Sunday comics, or the animated movies. Not even that good. So that leads me, I just thought I wanted to mention that, to as you might recall, the first Charles Kraft expose was in the Stranger magazine, which you can find at thestranger.com. You find the front page there. And if you Google The Stranger and Charles Kraft, you'll come up, no doubt, to that article about him on there. But this Stranger magazine, on the front page, you can see this is a Seattle-based magazine. They focus on art, but also lifestyle and recreational activities, food, music, film, art, theater, and is openly and outwardly homosexual. It's very left and very homosexual, and particularly Pitt, notice the under columns, Savage Love, which is this guy named Dan Savage who has been writing this for some time. It might be syndicated, I don't know. But it's, you know, he's homosexual and it's all about the life of homosexuals. You know, I'm just as though that was, you know, that was, you're talking about things that they're interested in and relate to. And it gets pretty, you know, pretty strong, in the imagery and the language and so on. He also has a YouTube. He makes YouTube videos, and he's kind of like a love columnist. So it's called Savage Love. People write to him like the old Dear Abby thing, and he answers them, you know, from the point of view of a gay person. So I'm going to start with there is that article which many people read and many people commented. It had over 200 comments. I don't know how many it has by now. They just kept going for a long time. But others then picked that up. It was written by just an editor of that magazine who wrote that article, who discovered some things about Charles, and she looked into it, and then she found the White Network and his programs with us, and mentioned in almost every one of these articles, but I don't know if it's given us any any more business from that. But she also then sent him some emails and asked some questions, and in the end she did this thing called Charles Kraft is a White Nationalist Who Believes the Holocaust is a Deliberately Exaggerated Myth. That's the name of her article. Well, then it was picked up by some other sites that are interested in art. This is, well, first one I'm going to mention is the Gallerist New York, galleristny.com, galleristny.com. And their article was Artist Charles Kraft is a White Nationalist and Holocaust Denier. That's what it was, titled something like that. And They say that an article in The Stranger about Charles Kraft says that he is a white nationalist who believes the Holocaust is a myth. Well, they just quote from that, from The Stranger article. And they say that they make the point that Kraft claimed in a 2009 interview with Salon, S-A-L-O-N, their Salon is on the internet, so that must be what they're referring to, I think. But this was quoted in The Stranger article too, that that his art, the symbols he used in his art, like swastikas, Third Reich imagery, and so on, were a projection of humorous irony. So everybody was taking it that he was kind of poking. He was just, I don't know, it was one of these things that's acceptable to these very left wingers to be clever, you know, some kind of cleverness about it all, not really serious. And, you know, art today, this website, gallerisnewyork.com, it reflects what art is today. It's a business. It's a business ever since it was taken over by Jews. It's become more and more concerned with how much money it commands. And is art as an investment in buying and selling, in just the same way Jews do with everything. Jews are the merchants, the peddlers, the buyers and sellers, and they take it to every level in our societies and turn that into, and we've been talking about that on the International Jew recently, dealing with the movie business, how they, once they take it over, it becomes a business. And we're used to everything now, the art business, the movie business, the theater business, you know, it's all become just business. And this is one point I want to make today. And let's see, I've got a quote here. I was just going to say, you know, they quote in all these articles, they quote what this stranger person who wrote the article in The Stranger took from the white network, from what we talk about here. And because he was on a podcast here and he said in this podcast, I believe the Holocaust is a myth. This is the one from July 28, 2012. Let's see. I had it down here. It was called "Should White Nationalists Leave the Holocaust Alone?" It was with me and Charles and Hanning Scott, and it was the topic that it was about was Greg Johnson's article at the Occidental Observer dealing with the Holocaust. If you recall that was another one. It had over 700 comments. It brought people out from all over. It was very, very controversial. Mostly people were against what Greg Johnson was saying. And so we did a program about this. And I mean, I wanted to do it and I asked these two people to do it with me. And I thought I was actually prepared for Charles to say no, but he didn't. Charles is a really good sport. Because I also wanted to talk about homosexuality along with it, since I think that has a lot to do with Greg Johnson's views of things. And so it was like, you know, I included that should white nationalists leave homosexuality alone too? I mean, should we include it or should we reject it? And so we dealt with both of those subjects. And Charles is not homosexual, but he, being an artist and in the art business and living all his life in Seattle, on the West Coast there, he's certainly knows a bunch of homosexuals, is around them a lot, and doesn't have anything against them. He is a very tolerant, open-minded person all the way around. And he doesn't, you know, he's not one of them. So we should get that clear. But he took the position that he didn't see anything wrong with having him in the movement. But I, and Hattie kind of went along with me that we don't want them in the movement. But that's just a little background there. So they quoted the whole about what we're about on our white network page, And of course they find that just terrible because, I have it here. Okay. Well, we talk about, I'm not going to read it. We state our views on who is white. And of course, if you just care about whiteness and talk about, you know, the difference between, you know, Jews aren't white and so on. Well, that's just, you know, shocking to them. These people who think they can't be shocked by anything. So, after that, so that was picked up there. And then on another site, it was picked up, another art site, hyperallergic.com, excuse me. And it's, they named it that because they're so sensitive to art. And they say, what do you do with white nationalist art once the irony's gone? That was the title of their version of the Charles Kraft expose that they got from the Stranger. And the person who wrote this is Jillian Steinhauer. Now, she was really pretty hardcore. After describing his art, she said, recently, however, it's become increasingly clear that Kraft isn't actually skewering Hitler, which is what they thought before. In fact, he's probably celebrating him. Graves, the Stranger's, author of the Stranger article, Graves compiles Kraft's own words from his Facebook page, the White Nationalist podcast with me that he was on, and well as an email exchange that she had. Anyway, she says, the results are damning. She was talking about how terrible the comments were. She couldn't believe that there were people still defending Charles after this discovery about him. And, some people advised to show support and defend him. That was, Greg Johnson in his article, and let this controversy die in the pages of the Stranger. And she writes after that, not if I can help it. So she wants to keep this thing going. And that is, I suppose, the feeling of some of the others, who do not want to forgive Charles, do not want to forget about this, do not want to let things go back to normal. I don't know. We'll have to see, what actually happens. It seems to me like a big deal over not much, but that's because I have a different view of the world. So then we go to the Huffington Post, which also picked this story up, in their art and culture section. You know, that Huffington Post is ultra liberal and totally 100% Democratic Party, if it comes to party politics, you know, and they cover a lot. That's a big site. Sometimes I've looked for things that I found, news stories that are hard to find, and there it is at Huffington Post, and they've covered it very well. They cover everything. They must have a big staff there. But so they even have this, even thought they'd pick up this story about Charles. And they titled theirs, Charles Kraft Accused of Being a White Nationalist and Holocaust Denier. And then a sub, colon thing. Associates Weigh In by Priscilla Frank, another female. And she pretty much ran a straight thing about what was in the Stranger, too. That's what everybody was doing. They were just picking up quotes from the Stranger and repeating it. But she said, she ended with this. They have to have their own beginning and ending, you know. And she ended with this, which is, to me, was reminiscent of what Anderson Cooper said to his audience about James Tracy, and this, who is the Sandy Hook media critic. If any of you are familiar with when Anderson Cooper is really deep into that Sandy Hook psyop with CNN, his employer, and all the media are. He, on his 360 show, I think it is, he spent the whole time talking about James Tracy, and in a way that was trying to get people to call for his being fired and, you know, destroy his, he's a professor at Florida Atlantic University. he has tenure, but he was, you know, without covering it up too much, being too subtle about it, he was trying to destroy this James Tracy, who's looking into the truthfulness of this Sandy Hook affair. And so she, like that, says at the end of her article, this Priscilla Frank. Now, Frank can very well be a Jewish name. And I wouldn't be surprised if all these people writing are Jews, except this next guy is not. But these others previous could have been. She wrote, "What should become of Kraft's works with this new knowledge of the artist's intention? Please let us know your thoughts in the comments." So she's suggesting, you know, here it is. These are supposed to be art people. She's suggesting what should become of his works, right? What should we do? Should we, you know, take them out of the museums that they're in? Should we destroy them? Should everybody, you know, put them in a place where they won't ever be seen or something? You know, what should we do with his artwork since we know his intentions? Well, his intention. Well, they don't know his intention, but anyway, you know, his intention is not what they thought it was. What she means is, we thought his intention was totally satirical, but now we think maybe his intention was to actually promote these symbols that he's using and so on. And this is just unacceptable. So what should happen to this art of his? And so it's all pretty vile. Now, the Huffington Post also allowed a man named Phil Campbell to write an editorial, or they published this editorial that he wrote about Charles. And he's really a good case. He says, he titled it, "When a Good Artist Turns Bad." "When a Good Artist Turns Nazi Sympathizer." That's I guess what he named it. And he writes, Phil Campbell writes, "My head's still spinning." The first Huffington Post story was on February 15th, it says. Boy, that was late. February 15th, and the other one followed after that. And he says, "My head's still spinning from this story, and I'm barely, if that, connected to any of it. Those at the center of this art world controversy," because he says he's not connected. He's not an artist. He's not connected to the art world, but his wife is. So we'll get to that. He says, "Those at the center of this art world controversy have got to be feeling something more akin to a horse kick in the stomach." Oh my gosh, to learn that somebody who they have harbored as a friend and fellow artist and so on, might deny the Holocaust or question the Holocaust. I mean, just, and of course, Charles Kraft is not really a white nationalist, although he'd have to answer that, but he's not big involved in white nationalism, although I think he's just sympathetic to it. But he has involved himself in just talking about, commenting on, writing comments in places, you know, different places and so on. He's pretty well known by his email name about Holocaust. So he's a big questioner of the Holocaust, but that's something that they just can't even get their head around. And he says he calls him an iconoclast bad boy who mocked the art world even as he profited from it. You know, and so he should, you know, again, you know, if you make any money at all selling your artwork and it's not something that they approve of politically in the end, then you're mocking, you know, and you shouldn't profit from it. No, nobody should profit except anybody. These ultra liberals are just so ready to make everybody who doesn't agree with them paupers, just paupers, shouldn't even be allowed to live. They want to take all your money away, your ability to earn a living, because you're putting out the wrong political point of view. Now, you know, Kraft came out with a series of ceramic plates that he called disasterware, and there's also some other things besides plates that are part of this disasterware series that include imagery of Nazis and other violent, disturbing images, he says. So any imagery just of a plain person, you know, figure in an SS uniform, even from the waist up, which I saw one of those on one of his things, not doing anything. But that's a violent, disturbing image to have. And in another, then he had his forgiveness series, Craft. He's very, very creative ideas, I'll say that. And, you know, since he took, this guy is saying that he's a provocateur, taking on some of the most difficult themes in art, death, violence, Nazis, and the Holocaust. Those are the most difficult themes in art, I guess, to talk about the Holocaust. Pictures of the Holocaust as art. And so then he says that in this The Stranger, Kraft revealed his awful secret. He is an admitted white nationalist and a Holocaust denier. This is what Campbell writes it. And he talks about the white network there too. And quotes our about page. And what Kraft said on that last podcast that I already mentioned. And then he later, further down, he says, I might sardonically laugh to myself at the idea of some shallow profiteering art collector who bought this art thinking it was a hot property, only to fret about that investment evaporating with these scandalous revelations. Well, you know, there was a story, you see, that they told before this, of this Jewish art collector who bought one of Charles Kraft's pictures, a water pitcher thing made in the form of Hitler's face, and there's a swastika on it somewhere. And this Jewish collector bought it, thinking it was some kind of mocking piece or something, you know. Not and now that he died, but they're saying, oh, this guy bought this for that reason. And if he learned now that it was that Kraft was maybe serious about these things, oh, he'd probably smash it, you know, or what would he do? It was so terrible. Do they feel so sorry for him? But this guy is saying, well, you know, if you're buying art to profit from it, which these people are, thinking the price is going to go up, that's why they buy it. I'm not saying they don't like it, but a lot of art sales are because people are buying from artists that they think they're are hot, and the price of their work will only go up, and they'll get richer from it. So that's just like you know, investing in the stock market and so on. And you don't have sympathy for people who buy stocks for that reason and then lose on their investment. You know, that's the market. That's the chance you take. But now with this, supposedly it's different. But he says that he might not be upset by that, but I have a really hard time feeling anything but sympathy, sadness, and anger for the Jewish collector who was conned. See, so he said, if you're just a regular person buying art for to see if it grows in value, well, you just have to take your chances. But for some reason, if you're a Jew, and you're conned, that's a terrible thing to do. I mean, this doesn't even make sense what he's saying, but he's saying it. He has a hard time feeling anything but sympathy, sadness, and anger for this Jewish collector who was conned by Charles Kraft, supposedly. You know, Jews are special. Jews are special to all these liberals. They can't get over it. What other people should just take as part of life's, what life hands out. Not Jews, though. Not Jews. We always have to have sympathy for them. And he's like that. If he's like that, his wife must be pretty much like that, too. Going on through this, he's at the bottom, he mentions his wife. He says, in 2003, I attended the opening of a performance exhibition of Kraft's. I was with my wife, Emily Hall, who was writing an arts piece for it about The Stranger. Well, that's where I learned about Emily Hall. So I looked her up. And before I go on to that, I'll just say that this Phil Campbell revealed that he was a former Catholic and but now he was delighted in works that were irreverent. He's become irreverent, I guess. And then he says, I'm trying to write an ending to this post, and I just can't. I can't make sense of any of it. We should be able to judge art apart from the personal politics of the artist, but Kraft's work doesn't allow for that. You see? You know, and I ask, why not? Why not? He says, we literally trusted him, you know, and the idea that his intentions were, you know, not entirely pure corrupts everything. But, you know, why should, he says, we should be able to judge art apart from the personal politics of the artist. Well, that's right, and that's always been held to be true. That's always been said, that if the art exists separately from the artist's personal political beliefs. What about Picasso, who was a communist, in all those years that we were anti-communist in the West, that everything was anti-communist, but he was always a communist, well, from a pretty young age. And that didn't bother anything. He was still hailed by the Jews as the greatest, you know, living artist of, and one of the greatest artists of all time, I used to believe that. Because I was taught that. I believed everything I was taught about art for so long. Well, a lot of it is. There's no reason to dislike most good art, real art. But today, it's different, what they call art. So we're going to get into that here real quick. So this is the end of this Hugh Campbell for now. So looking up his wife, Emily Hall, I found she was the visual arts editor at the Stranger magazine, this homosexual Seattle lifestyle magazine, and it's been around since 1999, where she started writing. She started writing right away. I don't know if this is right. That maybe it's her. Maybe I got this that it's her since 1999. Oh yeah, I've got this written in such a way. The magazine's been there longer, but it's been around for quite a while, a long time. But she started at the end of 1999, really, you might say, the beginning of the year 2000. And she wrote continually, every month, it seemed, something, you know, the art, something about art in that magazine. And you can find on their website, I looked at them, 27 pages in the art, you know, archived pages of Emily Hall's contributions, about 20 on each page. So I figure she's done about 500 published pieces for The Stranger in that 5 years, four or five years. And she wrote, she wrote about contemporary art in the Seattle area. That was the beat there. And, they love conceptual art. They love conceptual art now. Well, everywhere, conceptual art has been in for a long time, because you don't have to have any, what we always considered art talent, to do conceptual art, which is often installations of one kind or another, or either small ones that are mounted on a wall, or big ones that are even outdoors, or, you know, some large space, or taking up a whole big gallery of a single gallery of a museum. The art world is controlled by Jews, and they love to direct attention to homosexual artists. At one time, when conceptual art got started, when it was way back in my time, I mean, it goes way back, when the first ones came along, and you went, they were called things installations instead of a picture hanging on a wall or a sculpture on a pedestal. And some of them were really crude in the beginning and ugly, and they didn't amount to anything, but they were supposed to make you think about something that you wouldn't otherwise think about. And I'm not going to go into detail about the ones I remember, but it's still going on because Jews aren't artists, you know, and they can't They have never been good painters. Some of the best, of course, European Aryan people are the greatest painters. They are the ones who have developed the art to its highest, finest pinnacle. But then the Jews said, well, this has already been done. You can't do it any. Why should anybody do it anymore? Because art should always be about something new, pushing against what's like taboo or something, and pushing into something new. So the new things were always something like, it started out with Dada and surrealism and things like that, you know, and went on and on, which art schools that are, schools of art that are just accepted today and not even questioned that they're great art. But if you get the broad enough view, you might start to look at some of these things. And this is what the National Socialists did. They didn't like him, and they made that clear. They didn't think that they were good for the people. Well, there would be pros and cons on this, so I'll just continue here because we'll get into some of this. But for an example of what's going on, what she her reviews and how Ellen Hall thought about it all in 2000, in the year 2000, one of her reviews was titled "Urine for a Treat." Urine, spelled U-R-I-N-E. But, you know, as you say it for a while, try to figure it out, you realize it's supposed to be a play on words. You're in for a treat, you know. You're in for a treat, but it's spelled urine for a treat. And because it's, as she writes, it's an installation by Susan Robb and Jeff Miller, two Seattle artists who not incidentally are friends of mine, she says. The project is lit from within, glowing faintly blue and gold, floating in the darkness like a buoy. This was an installation put up outdoors, and you went to see it at night. And she says, this is what it is, a tower made of 400 jars of urine collected from artists around the country, stacked one on top of the other on 16 metal bases. The whole thing is about 7 feet high and lit by electroluminescent wires. And it is gorgeous, luminous, warm, kind of like biological stained glass. And the title of this masterpiece was The Golden Tower. And, you know, of course, you can question whether that urine was, those jars of urine really did come from 400 different artists from around the country, or if they didn't get that many of them to do it, so they just urinated in some to get all the jars they needed, because who knows where the urine came from. But anyway, that's the story they put out, makes it somehow more artistic, I guess, if the urine comes from real artists. Here I added something I think I already said about the conceptual art. So she goes on to write here. I hang around the Golden Tower for a while. And she went out to see it, of course, to write about it. And then I decide to go dancing. So it was near a place where they had places of business and so on. And she says, at Bianca's Smut Shack, the music is techno and loud and the crowd is dancing hard. No sooner do I decide I'm hungry than a woman comes through the crowd with a tray of hot grilled cheese sandwiches. They taste like manna. My next thought was, now I'd like a drink. And it was still nascent within her when she found herself offered a bottle of whiskey by a beautiful boy in Jesus robes. This is, you know, this is the scene out there. And the rest, then she says, the rest of the story doesn't bear telling here. Now, you know, what kind of a woman is this? Did she and the boy, you know, drink the bottle of whiskey together and then disappear into the night or something? Or disappear into the night to drink the whiskey? Anyway, he was beautiful, she said, and wearing Jesus robes. So this is what you find here. And on this the Stranger, they have some pretty interesting advertisements in their magazine. And one of them that I saw on one of her pages was for Beds and More, a company named Beds and More. And they chose to use a photo for this to advertise their wares in this magazine of two young males with chunky, really chunky bare chests, really work out a lot. And they were sitting up close together in a bed, and one's arm was around the other, and they were reading a newspaper, the same newspaper, with their coffee. So the idea was that, of course, they were naked in there in bed, you know. The heading of the ad was "Snuggle up this Valentine's Day in natural and organic bedding." So that's just a normal thing in that magazine, where, you know, where you see these guys, and sometimes, not very often, gals, but mostly guys, you know, together. It's just acceptable lifestyle. And I already mentioned the Savage Love column. So in 2004, Emily Hall wrote a farewell letter because she decided she was leaving. She'd had enough of Seattle, actually. She writes, I don't think I'm going to bother reading this whole thing. It's not that long, but she's critical of Seattle. Not enough money there. Not enough really good support of artists. You know, it's supposed to be one of the important art centers of the United States, but it doesn't compare to New York, and it's really backwater compared to New York. And she's not getting anywhere. I guess she feels like she's not going anywhere. And so she concludes and says goodbye, but she didn't leave right away. However, I learned that from something here that she now lives in New York City. After she left Seattle, I don't know if she went straight to New York City, but anyway, she went to New York City. And it appears that she was also thought of herself as an artist. So while she was being an art critic, she was also an artist, and she was trying to become an artist in New York City. And I looked her up in the, you know, as an artist and in galleries and so on. And it only showed that she was represented by one gallery, White Columns Gallery, which lists her name in this huge block of names that I would have to estimate was at least 1,000 names. But I'm not very good at estimating. I should have counted the number of names in one line and then multiplied by the number of lines, but I just thought of that. I didn't bother doing that. It doesn't really matter to me, but it's just that it's a lot of people and they're all listed alphabetically. So, you know, I don't know how successful this White Columns Gallery is, and they just seem to have everybody who wants to be represented by them there, but they couldn't really take care of that many of them in any good way. So that's all that she is. She's just nowhere. And so it says it's a good thing she has a husband, Mr. Phil Campbell. He writes too, you know. He has his own blog now, but he's written something that's been turned into a movie, and he's been writing about that. But in 2001, I want to mention, talking about art here, that Emily Hall wrote something called Why Most Painting is Bad. And she said, she was trying to figure out what painting lacks. And this is so telling about what has happened to the art world under the Jews. She says it's the veneration for the medium of painting has outgrown its significance. Painting doesn't matter. It's no longer the yardstick by which art is measured. No, it's the conceptual art. she says, you know, she talks about how painting developed from its primitive, you know, primitive attempts to copy nature into its heyday. You know, I'm putting this in my own words, but, you know, its pinnacle in the Renaissance time when there were so many artists who had mastered perspective and naturalism and so on and could do, you know, wonderful things with it. And then the idea came shortly after that, really, at the same time that the Jews were gaining their emancipation and in the 19th century, when art was being, you know, when contemporary artists were found, a lot of them Jews, not all though, to try to push things into a new direction. And we got into a type of abstracting reality in different ways, and there are a lot of schools that are now very well known and famous, and the artists and the work, whether artists are all dead, but the work brings, you know, lots of money, and they're in all the museums and art museums and so on. So this has been pushed and pushed. And she says this momentum was the progress from primitive rendering to faithful imitation or mimicry. The Jews love to call the wonderful naturalistic art that the Aryan people achieved as mimicry and imitation. And then, of course, photography came in, and so they'd say, well, you can just take a photograph of this stuff. You don't have to paint it. Well, the painting was very different from the photograph, but, you know. And she says, and she includes in that, the progress then went to Greenberg's drive for purity and freedom from content. This is this Jew, Clement Greenberg, who became a very famous art critic for whatever reason. Same reason they become famous in everything. And she says that his drive for purity and freedom from content certainly kicked down the door for that pluralism that is art in our time. That is, for all these new kinds of waves of new art, new types of art, and so on. He's responsible for that, she said, because he wanted freedom from content. That is, it didn't have to mean anything. You know, you didn't have to do things that had any meaning to the people who were looking at it. So she starts talking about what culture does. She says, culture entertains us and comforts us. The result is a loss of willingness to be transported. No, she says, if you want that kind of comfortable culture of things that you're used to and things that you understand and imagery and so on, it results in a loss of willingness to be transported by art beyond our limits. I thought that was a pretty good way of describing what they're trying to do. You know, it's like code for destruction of your value system. To be transported, they say, you need to be transported beyond your current beliefs and your limits, which are just limiting you. And so you go to look at things that are totally, you know, incomprehensible. And you're supposed to find some message in it that is going to take you out of your current zone of thinking and into something, you know, beyond. Well, that is exactly, you know, a lot of people fell for that. I used to mimic stuff like that, say things like that, you know, in defense of this art. You know, it takes a lot of being solidly rooted to be able to understand that this is a hoax in a sense. You know, this is just not because we see where it's led. It's led to this kind of art where you have people who are considered to be, you know, very promising artists collecting urine in jars and piling them up on some stands and putting some light on it at nighttime and, it, you know, calling it art. She says that you have to push it. Art today, and this all comes from the Jews, is to push against the world and also push against itself. That is, push against the art of the past. You're supposed to, you know, not want to repeat the art of the past. You can question it in your new art and things like that. But she says that art that is life affirming, she actually says this, art that is life, this pushing against helps you to think abstractly and helps you to question everything. You're supposed to, you know, that's the culture of critique, question everything. But an art that is life affirming, which is what the National Socialists wanted, creates a stupefying inertia, she writes, a philosophical deficit that is very hard to see past. Now, this is the kind of language they use, and this is the kind of language with which they have bamboozled people, particularly intellectuals and so on, to believe and to think that this is right, that that which is life-affirming is just boring, stupefying, same old thing. You know, we need to push past that. And what is beyond life-affirming? Well, you know. So now Phil writes his own... on his own blog, I am Phil Campbell. look that up if you want. And there he is. And he wrote one blog, One Mile Film, and a shameless plug. Well, the plug was for his wife. He says, go buy this month's art form. Seriously, my wife, Emily Hall, an art critic and an editor of publications at the Museum of Modern Art, has a review in the magazine. Well, you know, when he calls her an editor of publications at the Museum of Modern Art, and the Museum of Modern Art is just a big Jewish palace of all, you know, postmodern art, really. And well, modern, there, you know, you find all that. Art today is contemporary. Modern is old. Modern art is from the past, back in the, you know, 19th century and early 20th century. That's modern art. Now we have contemporary. After that, they had to call it contemporary to distinguish. And I suppose started with things like pop art and stuff. But she's not the editor of publications at the Museum of Modern Art. She's an editor. And she doesn't, she managed to do this one thing, get this one thing in there. So I would say that Emily Hall went to New York, and she got some kind of a temporary, you know, part-time job maybe with the Museum of Modern Art, but she hasn't made a big success, and neither has her husband, Phil, who is trying to play up his wife. But he also, on his blog, wrote an essay on Charles Kraft, and he titled it Charles Kraft Shudder. He put in parentheses after Charles' name, in Shudder. That's his, you know, this is how far gone these people are. And I just thought I'd point that out in the first part of this show. Gee, I could say some more, but it's probably I've gotten the most important part in. So I want to thank you for listening to this part of the show, and I'll be back in 5 minutes with Harlan Schulte.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed that. You know, I have been saying that the singer's name wrong, I think. You know, it takes me so long to finally pay attention and say, now, wait a minute, how would this be pronounced? I was calling her. I think her first name is pronounced Moika. Anyway, Moika Erdmann, the last name is definitely German, and that is Mozart's aria to an unfinished opera, and it is called in English Sleep Safely, because in the past I sometimes mistakenly said Sleep Softly. The German words kind of look that way, so then I start thinking, but it's Sleep Safely, and I think that's very nice. I think it's very nice. So this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on March 2nd, 2013, hour two. And I am waiting for Harlan Schulke to call in now. He will probably be calling in any minute. We decided it'd be easier for him and me too, actually, for him to just call in on his phone. He likes using his phone in the second hour rather than call in on Skype, or he couldn't be here the whole time. So he'll be calling. And, you know, Harlan Schulke was on my program only several weeks ago on the, I think it was this very one, Saturday afternoon, and we talked about the protocols of Zion and the different translations make it come out. And he's very interested in all types of what he calls now deceptions. You know, he got very involved in 9/11, and he's looked into lots of what people consider conspiracy events. But he says he now likes to call them deceptions, and I think that's a good word. So I said in the announcement that Sandy Hook, I called it Sandy Hook. What did I call it? Anyway, I use both hoax and, deception, hoax, or psyop. And he considers that all about the same. But he thinks now that deception is a better word than conspiracy, because conspiracy causes people to, and here he is calling. So let me get my Skype page up. Okay. Hold on there, Harlan. This should bring him up. We'll just wait to hear his voice here. Yep, here he is. Hi, Harlan.
Carolyn, hello. Good morning.
Well, it's morning for you. You're on
morning
the
for
West
me.
Coast.
Well, it just passed into the afternoon, I guess. To be totally accurate.
That's right. Well, I hope you've had a good morning.
Uh-huh, I did.
All right. Well, I'm just so glad to have you here. I already introduced you and told people who you were. You'd been on before. If you want to say anything more, you know, you have some websites now, and I wasn't sure which ones you would want to, put out there or which you wouldn't. And so why don't you tell us whatever you want to about how people can learn about some of your work?
Okay. Well, I'm still putting things up, so it's all kind of preliminary. But I do have a blog that I'm just starting. It's called Gnats and Camels. And that one is at, I just took down the link to that. I think it's WordPress.
Gnatsandcamels.press.com?
Yeah. Right. Uh-huh. I believe so. I can just confirm that. WordPress. Yeah, we're at WordPress. Uh-huh. Gnatsandcamels.wordpress.com, I believe it is. But for today, I put up a temporary link at a different location just so we'd have some images to look at while we talk. And that is at www.truememes.com/shimages.html. So I'll spell that out. It's www.truemes.com/sh_images.html.
Okay, good. I want to go there too. www.truemems.com/sh_images. Then what?
Just dot HTML.
Okay, HTML.
So why don't you type that in and see if it comes up.
Yeah, I'm going to do that.
Posted this a few minutes ago, so.
Well, you go ahead and talk some more about yourself while I type this in.
Okay. Well, like you, I'm just trying to make sense out of all this. And by this, I mean the wide range of issues that we're dealing with, both current and historical, and trying to put it all into some kind of a context where it begins to make sense, because there's so many strange things that we're expected to believe, both historically and in terms of current events, that just do not add up.
Okay, you know, it didn't come up. I've got www. Maybe I'll change it to, I'm on the search page here. I'm just going to have TrueMems. I'm going to leave that part off. TrueMems.com, sh_, is it / sh_, images.html. Uh-huh. Well, let me try again here.
Did you get the TrueMems part spelled right? So it's www.truememes.
Yeah, I've got that. .com/ sh. It's not coming up.
images.html.
Yeah. It's not coming up. You've got it, but it's not coming up for me. Let me put it in the, maybe it's because I'm not, let me put it in this, in the URL thing. I've got to get rid of all this. Well, keep going with your story about yourself. I have to get there. So let me open up my page here. I've got this page brought in, you know, small, and that's probably why I'm having a problem. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Well, what we see happen so often is deceptions. I mean, I don't know any other way to describe what we're seeing. I mean, with Sandy Hook, with gas chamber story, with 9/11, all these highly manipulative events that are, from all indications, preconceived for, you know, a purpose, and then delivered into our minds through media of one form or another. And then we look at this and we're kind of left scratching our heads going, what in the world is going on? Who is doing this? How can they pull off these, you know, complex fabrications?
So, I'm having trouble with this, but I'm still working on it.
Okay, hasn't come up yet? It should.
TrueMems blog. No, TrueMems. Okay, TrueMems.
.com.
Yeah, I'm not going to click on this thing that's coming up because it might be the one I already did, which wasn't good. You got one here with Wagner too. I think I've been to that. So let me just put in the last part of this again.
Okay.
I keep checking it to see that everything's spelled right. It is.
Yeah,
S-H.
What's that?
Let me just see here. There it is. Okay, now I've got it.
Did it come
so
up?
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So we're all set.
All right, great.
I think I had a space in there.
Maybe so.
I didn't see it visually, and I didn't know it was there. All right.
Yeah, syntax is everything.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about Sandy Hook. Let me get back to my own page. And I've got some pictures too, but I don't have them on place where people can see them, but they can go to the website where they're at. But I have just made my own notes that I thought I would talk about Adam Lanza,
mm-hmm.
who I really looked at, and I really, believe that he's a shooter. And also Natalie Hammond. I was talking to you about her, and I looked up and found some more stuff. So
what did you find out about Natalie Hammond?
Because, do you think we should do a little overview, or should we go right to this?
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, from an overview perspective, I would say the big question is whether anything actually happened at all. You know, that seems to be the, you know, on the far extreme, there's just believing what we're told. But then there's this middle position where, well, it wasn't quite what we're told, but people were actually killed. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end of the extreme, there's, well, nothing actually happened at that school at all. The school was abandoned. There were no kids there. Nobody was killed. And the whole thing is a hoax. It's an fabrication. Those are the kind of the spectrum of views that were.
Well, what gets me is that you have these people who did that, your second one, who say, well, something's wrong with this. It's not what it's, you know, they've lied about a lot, but it did happen. You know, somebody killed these kids and they think it was this boy. No reason not to. They don't want to question that. But then they say it doesn't make any difference because, you know, they just don't think it makes any difference. There's no point in spending time with it. And I just don't understand that at all.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important to get to the bottom of this.
And then there's some people, these same people, will also say that it's not important to look into 9/11 anymore. We know that, it's, you know, what came of it and how badly it's been used and so on, as this will is done for that reason. But again, they don't want to spend any time on it, and they don't know that much, but they have never really studied it like people like you and to some degree like me have studied it all and are convinced. And so I don't understand the idea that it's not important. Now, these people will all say the Holocaust is important.
Well, not they don't say it's important, but they say that, well, you know, it was this or that, but it's mainly how it's been used.
Well, that's right. That's right. But these people will all say, oh, it is important to expose the Holocaust, but they don't think it's important to worry about these more contemporary things. And I just don't get that at all. I have to come down on the side that it's terribly important. And if we would do it, everything would blow apart. And I have to wonder why it's not that these people don't want things to blow apart, but maybe they don't want the world to blow apart. Part that badly, you know, that big. Maybe they think that would be somehow too so destabilizing. Go about it another way. You know, that's just what comes to my mind. Because I think we do need to recognize that there are people with different views on this. And just like I was talking in the first hour about the art, you know, you can't understand what the other where the other person is coming from. It's so unreal to you, you know.
There's always a real factual reality behind all of these things at some level, regardless of what anyone believes. And as far as I'm concerned, that should always be our goal, is get a grasp on the actual facts of what really happened, not just pick among a menu of beliefs.
Right.
So our
me too, because I think that, I don't know, maybe I could be put to the test on certain things and I might not be so good on it, but I think that I want to know the truth.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
I think the truth is going to be on my side. I mean, it's going to be what, you know, on the side that I think is the good side. I do believe that. So I'm not afraid of the truth, but I think some people.
No, we can't be afraid of the truth. Just the
opposite. How can you?
We should be afraid of being deceived.
Yeah, right.
Anytime we accept a belief that's not connected to reality, it disconnects us from reality. And it has a, you know, profoundly deteriorating effect on our ability to understand what's going on.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I mean, I always wanted to know the truth of things from the time I was a kid. And people saying, oh, people can't stand it because it's too upsetting for them. People can't handle the truth and so on. I don't understand that either. Because, you know, I always could. I mean, I wanted it, you know, and I would be so elated.
The truth is invigorating.
Yes. So you and I are on the same wavelength with this. So, okay, if you want me to talk about Natalie Hammond, and then we can go into some of this TV footage and so on.
Okay, great.
Because I think the Adam Lanza questions are pretty clear to most people. I would just be repeating that, but I do not believe that Adam Lanza was the shooter, and I think. Also, it's a terrible thing that they've done to him and his mother, especially him, to make this guy the arch nutcase, you know, murderer, monster that they have, you know, when you see some of the photographs of him, Natural that came out in this Frontline series, I guess. You know, he just looks like a sweet kid.
Just and like he doesn't a normal, have that, kid, yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't have that distorted face and that huge long chin that
they big,
show him
weird
in that,
eyes.
In that famous picture. So we can come back to him, but Natalie Hammond is someone who I was very interested in, and she is described as one of the wounded survivors.
She's and supposedly still alive.
She is alive, and mm-hmm. I saw her on a video just a few days ago. And it's different than what I was saying. I watched it again and figured out what the heck she was doing there. The Boston Bruins came to Newtown to, do this nice thing for the Newtown kids and put on a ice hockey match there, and then spent time with the kids, you know, the players and so on. And she's a big Boston Bruins fan. I don't know if this is all arranged. You know, it could be all media arranged, see. And so they asked her to come, and they asked her to drop the puck. That's something that they do at the beginning of a...
They're like throwing out the first pitch?
Something like that, dropping the puck. So she was assigned to do that, and there was they did a short video of her, not at the game, but some at the gym or something where the kids were, and I'll talk about how much the kids missed her, and they hadn't seen her because she'd been in the hospital. She still had her leg in a cast, I guess, supposedly from these bullets hitting her leg. They never are clear about how many. I mean, the whole story of her has changed and adapted so much. So now I'm going to go down to that, and let me.
Yeah, well, the changing of the stories, that's something we've seen.
Yeah, and she...
I've seen that with Gene Rosen.
Well, the first thing that came out on December 15th, the day after the event, was that the principal... There was a meeting in the principal's office, and that they heard these sounds, these pops or something, and they ran out into the hallway, you know, just running out after whatever would be there, like kind of like fools. And she and the school psychologist and the vice principal went. The vice principal wasn't named. The school psychologist is Mary Sherlach, and the principal was Don Hochsprung. And they were killed by this gunman they found. But the vice principal was only wounded. They said she had a shot in her leg and her arm and her hand, something like that. Well, it turned out, later that another story that she didn't go with them. Two stories said that CNN also came out on the just sometime in December in their timeline that the vice principal Natalie Hammond, they named her, went out with these other two, and
was all supposedly after he shot his way into the building.
Right.
So there would have been like shattering glass and all kinds of gunfire. I mean, that's not the kind of thing where you just, let me see what's happening. I'll just run out here and see what's going on after something like that, especially with their security system.
Yeah, the security system is another thing that they don't. Nobody has explained why there's nothing there.
So even when the kids talk about the gunfire, it's like somebody was kicking a door, or it was like pop, pop, pop. You know, it's like that's not like gunfire sounds like.
Especially if he was shooting
his way into the building and shattering. You've seen pictures of the building. There's like, you know, major glass across the front.
Well, that's one thing they've never shown. I don't remember the picture. And nobody's ever talks about it. There was a story, you know, of one parent that came to the school and with her daughter or something. And then the daughter said, "Look, Mom." And then they saw all this broken glass, at the entrance. I don't know. They had heard something about it, or I don't know what,
but that
disappeared. Yeah. That kind of stuff is all that kind of stuff that comes out. So here they have Natalie Hammond named as being running out in the hallway with the other two. So she would have seen what this gunman looked like. I mean, of course,
he
had a mask
story,
and stuff. Yeah. But then they changed the story and said that she was stayed in the principal's office, and just those two ran out there, and she was holding the door shut with her body, and the shooter shot through the door and hit her, and it was once in several places besides the leg, but then later it was just the leg. So mm-hmm. she had a couple or three shots, bullets in her leg or something.
So and, she never actually now, saw.
So she wouldn't see him. Yeah. So now she has nothing to tell except that she was in the office and holding the door shut. And mm-hmm. I was waiting for this person. I was looking her up. I found her name and everything. And I found this story that was written by her friend. Let me get to that. Yeah, here it is. It came out in the newtimes.com. I don't know. It's an internet site. Newtimes.com. It was an article, Sandy Hook Survivors Wit and Will, a Weapon for Whatever. And it was about an interview with her best friend on December 17th. Now, we're talking about just 3 days later. Anna Kosansky was interviewed about the survivor Hammond, saying she's just an incredible person, a great mom, and she lives in Naugatuck. Where's Naugatuck? Anyway, Anna Kosansky lives in Naugatuck. Is that maybe Long Island or something?
I don't know.
She was supposed to be Hammond's best friend. They say she's Hammond's best friend of 22 years, a roommate and sorority sister at this college they attended and where Hammond earned her elementary education and sociology degree in 1994. And then she said that Hammond was the lead, had recently been promoted to lead teacher at the school, and that she knew that she would survive, you know, she would survive her wounds and it would all be well, and she was so happy, blah, blah. But anyway, it says here, then, some story, I don't know if it's the same story or not now. So many stupid things in here. That Natalie Hammond, lead teacher in the meeting room, pressed her body against the door to keep it closed. Lands a shot Hammond through the door in her leg and arm. But later it was just the leg, see? And she was treated at Danbury Hospital. And now she's at this Bruins thing. Oh, she was a guest at the State of the Union address. You know, waiting for her to say something, but now she can't. I thought, how are they going to get to her to keep her from saying, you know, what she knows? Well, they did, I guess, unless they just put out these false stories in the beginning. Who can tell?
If she says she is, yeah.
Well, she doesn't say any. She hasn't said anything.
I mean, who they say she is.
Well, they now, she was at the State of the Union address. Teacher Natalie Hammond, who was shot on December 14th, will attend the event is guest of U.S. Representative Elizabeth Esty, reported by the Hartford Courant. And then there's another story afterwards that she was there and that state representative says, as the representative for Newtown and as a mother, this is this congresswoman, I feel a special responsibility to that community and to the parents who have suffered such unimaginable horror. And she said, in January, she spoke to the town's second community discussion on the fate of the Sandy Hook School, telling the crowd she had the ear of Vice President Joe Biden. And she said, I don't know how we're going to do it, but we'll do it. Now, they don't say what she said they were going to do, but obviously, tear down the school. Oh, gun control. I thought it was... They were discussing at this second community discussion. You see, I was paying a lot of attention to the fact that they were having these discussions in Newtown about...
Well, I know they're talking about tearing down the school, of course.
Yeah, well, that's what this was, a discussion on the fate of the Sandy Hook School.
Yeah.
And she says, I don't know how we're going to do it, but we'll do it. You decide what you need. Our job is to make it happen as quickly as possible. So they mean what they need is the permission or the authority and the.
Was that with Biden though?
Well, this is it. You know, they're going to find out how they can, they want help in tearing down the school. And, she's going to get Joe Biden is helping her with this.
Huh.
You know, this is where this thing is just nuts. It's nuts. And they put out these goofy stories. And most people aren't even reading them. And if you, when they do tear that school down, nobody mm-hmm. will care.
Yeah.
And yeah. you were talking about, you know, and I've read these same stories, that this school has been vacant for 3 years or something like that. And,
oh, 3 years. Yeah, I don't know.
No, I don't know. What
different
what
people are saying it's been vacant for differing amounts of time.
Yeah, I just came up with that 3 years. But
the helicopter footage from the, you know, that zooms in on the school, particularly the footage around the back and also the early footage around the front, none of the windows have any decorations in them, you know, no Christmas decorations. You know, an elementary school less than 2 weeks before Christmas, snowflakes or Santa Clauses or anything in the windows is very, very peculiar.
And you can see that real clear from these pictures you're talking about.
Yeah, you can see it very clearly from the helicopter footage.
And when was this? And this footage was from the day.
It's all from the day of the event.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really have any examples of. Well, you can kind of see it in, I don't know if you can, it's hard to tell from these particular stills that I put on this list. But, if we want to look at something that's no question fake, right at the top of this sequence of images is a screenshot from the CNN news, one of their early reports from Sandy Hook, you know, which shows the guys running across the parking lot.
Yes.
Right. So somebody's put that together with some aerial footage of a drill that was at the St. Rose of Lima School, apparently, earlier in the fall. And in the next image down, you can see a comparison of the parking lot from St. Rose to the parking lot that shows up in the CNN footage. And it's obviously, this is not from Sandy Hook, even though CNN is saying it is. So the shot of these guys running across the parking lot, they're using footage from a drill to convince us that this was something that actually happened at Sandy Hook. And then if you go down a little farther, the one that says News 12 Connecticut, that's an overview of the St. Rose School. That's a part of that same footage, you know, that continues on from the guy who's running across the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch the whole clip, then it zooms out. So you can see the school, and from that next Google screenshot, you can tell by comparing them that that's obviously the St. Rose School. That's not Sandy Hook.
Right.
So that's a clear case of a fabrication where CNN, courtesy of Anderson Cooper up in the corner there, mm-hmm. putting his stamp of approval on it, is faking it. I mean, there's no question about that one. That's, like, really obvious.
Well, it could be that a lot of these, a lot of this footage, even of talking to parents and children,
uh-huh.
might be from, I'd have to study this more, but might be from one of these drills, because they
yeah.
make these drills real realistic, and they have these actors and stuff to come and do it. And
uh-huh.
you know, we it's been commented on how these kids are so mm-hmm. you know, undisturbed by it all, and they give their little speech, you know, about
yeah.
what happened, and the parents are there looking kind of mm-hmm. serious but not too upset, and you only see a few of them, and the whole setting is, there's something false about it, and
yeah.
if the people milling
around.
Yeah, it doesn't
have any seriousness about it. It doesn't have the feeling of seriousness that there would be if there was actually a massacre that had gone on.
Yeah. And so since there were these drills, and we always seem to be dealing in these PSYOPs with
mm-hmm.
you know, like even with 9/11 with drills going on, mm-hmm. that there was one just 16 or so miles from Sandy Hook, another town. And there was mm-hmm. a drill going on that very morning, one of these safety drills. And I read somewhere that you know, it would have been easy for some of the people that were gathered there at that for that drill to just come over to Sandy Hook and show up there
mm-hmm.
to add something to you know, to some people there and so on. But also when we see that's very noticeable when we see these aerial views of that day, we see, as you pointed out, nothing going on at Sandy Hook, and everything's at the firehouse. I mean, there's something going on at the firehouse.
Mm-hmm. And the access is all blocked by cars.
Yes, right.
There's no way you could even get to the school if you wanted to.
Yeah, because they didn't want anybody going there.
Yeah.
You know, and if people would pay, only a few people, because Sandy Hook was not as dramatic as 9/11. And maybe we've become more used to these things, and so we, you know, take it with a grain of salt or something. So mm-hmm. there's not enough people really studying this. There are people doing it. You know, there's a lot of people. But in proportion, there's not a lot. People are just letting it go by. They've got more important things they think to talk about and think about. But if people would really take a look at all these anomalies, you can't not believe. I mean, you can't believe that. I don't think that you can't accept that this thing really happened, because if it really happened, why isn't there any evidence of anything happening?
Yeah, right. It's all just stories. It's all just, you know, it's just like with the Holocaust. It's all eyewitness testimony with no actual hard evidence or empirical evidence. It's a combination of that and false captioning, you know, where they take a real picture and then put a false caption on it. So like this, this thing at the top, you know, where they take the footage from St. Rose and call it Sandy Hook. You know, that's an example of false captioning,
right,
which is, you know, a favorite trick that we've seen over and over again. You know, I just ran across another interesting detail. If you scroll down a little bit, and we're right in the one where it says in this door and out this door, and then below, right below that, there's a shot that's from the inside of the firehouse.
Okay, go all the way down past the pictures of the ambulances and so on.
Right.
Stretchers.
That's another one.
Yeah, we'll go back to that. Then in this door.
Out this door. And then right below that, there's a shot of the people inside the firehouse.
Yeah.
It's kind of standing around.
Right. Looking
with water
forward.
Bottles off to the side. I found the source of that is a woman who's got this blog up. And she says that she found that in a tweet by a Connecticut NBC reporter that was at 6:36 a.m. on December 14th.
I used this picture, and I said that very thing, except not the time. On my second program that I did on Sandy Hook, was called Sandy Hook 2.
Mm-hmm.
I did that one by myself, and I found this picture right afterwards, and I grabbed hold of it, and yeah, it was from a woman who had some kind of official position, and she tweeted it, and but it just said it was the firehouse in the morning. I figured it might be around. I thought it was 9 something.
Well, according to this, it was like 6:36 a.m.
Well, what time zone was that?
I shouldn't say.
Well, you have to know what time zone it is.
Yeah, well. Yeah, I don't know. I'm assuming it's from the time zone.
So if it's 6 something in California and in Connecticut, it would be 3 hours later.
Yeah. Well, it could be.
And that's what I would make it 9. I think that's what I had. And it looks like it supposedly was right after the shocking event. And all the people were supposed to gather, all the concerned parents and kids and everything were supposed to be gathering in the firehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And this picture, though, unless there's more people somewhere else, but I don't know how big this firehouse is where people could actually stand around. There's not that many people, and they just look like they're, you know, like the ones outside did, like they.
Yeah.
They're just hanging out.
One kid. There's no kids in the picture except for that one girl in the pink shirt.
That one girl and another one further in the middle with a pink shirt.
Right.
No, and a boy, another one standing next to her, two short people, kids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Right. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is an amazing picture in the firehouse. And then this going in circles business. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so you look at the next three. I pulled this off somebody's video, but he, you know, you can see the arrows in the next. There's a sequence of three images.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually watch the video, which is not the raw footage that's pulled from is linked just above. That link that says going in circles, that's not the video that has the arrows in it. It's actual raw footage that was taken from.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see clearly that there's this ring of people just going around the building. They come out the door, they go around the side, they go around the back where those some vehicles are parked, and then they just come back out the front. They just go around and around and around.
Well, who do you think...
It's the strangest thing.
Who do you
meanwhile,
think these people are? People want to know who these people are. That's the first thing they'll ask skeptics. Well, who are these people? Why would they agree to do that?
Well, the speculation that at least some have put forward is that they're FEMA employees.
Oh,
you know, they're actors hired by FEMA. to do a simulation, you know, to do, you know, sort of.
And this is the firehouse.
That is the firehouse.
And so if there were drills going on, mm-hmm. and these people could be persuaded that they were going to be in a drill and they needed to do this, you know, to make it look like something or other. Because not that everybody wouldn't participate in a big hoax like this if they knew it. But these people, I think they don't know.
Well, they don't know, or they're just employed to be doing what they're doing.
Yeah, and they don't ask questions, I guess. And
they don't ask too many questions. So the next couple of shots are screen captures that show how that footage was used in the news.
Oh, okay.
Those two red framed images,
yes. uh-huh.
those are actual screen grabs from live news reports at the same time. So you can see in the insets to the right, that's how that scene was used to make it look like something was happening. So, you know, so they zoom, they crop in on it and do little video clips in these windows in the network, you know, in the news reports. And mm-hmm. if you're not looking too closely, oh yeah, gee, it looks like something's going on.
Yeah, right.
But
right, and they always have it right there. Where you're going to read the 27 dead, including 18 children in Newtown. You know, they
right.
know how repetition works, and man, does it ever. And every
uh-huh.
time you read any story about Sandy Hook, any, they will repeat at least once
mm-hmm.
when Adam Lanza shot 20 children and 7 adults to death. You know, they always have just the same way that whenever they say, write anything about the Holocaust or Holocaust survivors or
they
anything, they repeat
yeah.
when the Nazis killed 6 million Jews.
Right.
You know, and so people don't recognize how constantly seeing that in a situation that
form.
They're supposed to be believing, you know, like the newscasts mm-hmm. and so on, how that just makes that unquestionable in their minds, yeah,
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Right.
But yeah, it's how it works. And by having control of all the means of communication and all the communication facilities,
mm-hmm.
they're able to indoctrinate people the
yeah.
way they want.
Just like you say, just by right repetition.
But these are all people who aren't paying attention, who don't even give a thought that they're being lied to.
Yeah. So now these next couple of images are interesting. I found them. They're stills from a video that somebody else put together. It's done a detailed analysis on the shadows,
mm-hmm.
the shadow length and the shadow angle to
mm-hmm.
Estimate the time at which these images were taken. So
right.
according to this person's analysis, those shots that we see of the people walking around in circles, those were around 11 a.m. approximately. So it's interesting to compare that timing.
Okay, 11 Eastern time. Yeah.
Yeah, so you can see it in red. It's a little hard to read, but
yeah,
it says 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of did my own little analysis on that. So if you look at the next one down, the one that's kind of pink, the
yes.
close in on the parking lot, you can see the angle of the people. There's a little group of three people standing there. You see the angle of their shadows is parallel to those crosshatch lines in the parking lot?
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah, okay. They're not 11 o'clock.
So the next one down, this is just a shot from Google Earth. It's not of that day, but it's a shot of the Sandy Hook with correctly oriented in terms of east, west, north, south.
Mm-hmm.
So the sun would be rising in the east, but at a low angle because it was the middle of winter. And so I looked up the data that on that day, December 14th, the sun rose at 7:12 and it set at 4:24. So mm-hmm. midpoint of the day would have been about 11:47 a.m. So if you look at the angles of the lines in the parking lot, you know, you can't get an accurate read on it, but you can tell from that it's from the shadows in the image just above that's video was from sometime in the morning, you know,
mm-hmm.
sometimes say, probably between 11 and 11:45, 11:30, something like that, which matches up pretty closely then with the screen grabs that are just below that in blue that do have timestamps on them from the network. You know, we'll see where it says 11:47.
Yeah.
So we've got 11:47 there. We've got something that probably corresponds to that pretty closely in the thing above, and then the other guy's estimations of more like closer to 11 o'clock. But it's all in that window of time. You know, it's within the timing of the actual incident, you know, whatever happened. You know, if the shooting supposedly started at 9:30, if you listen to the police audio record, you know, there's a recording of the police talk, you know, the police radio talk.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've listened to that, but it's a bunch of different links to it. And, you know, according to the transcript of that, which who knows if it can all be believed, it actually sounds like more like a drill than reality,
mm-hmm.
if you listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still supposedly stuff going on. We have a rifle, shotgun, building is... even after 10 o'clock going on to 10:30, there's, you know, still supposedly all this stuff going on with the in and around the building.
But this is the firehouse on this first picture with the blue background.
Right, right.
This is not the school, right?
That's not the school. That's the firehouse.
Yeah.
Right. So the point is that if that's about the time when that was happening, you know, now that could have been recorded early and they just inserted it. In other words, that shot doesn't tell.
That might be the time that this is the current time that
it might be. It says live chopper. You know, so we're being led to believe that was live.
Oh, okay.
Live footage.
You're right.
And even if that's true, if it's 11:47 and that's live footage, 11:47, that's really still close on to the event. You know, which was still ongoing even at 10 o'clock going into 10:30. But you can see from that the access is blocked. You know, there's no way ambulances are going to get in or out, or anybody's going to get in or out of the school. You know, if you go down to the next one below, where it pulls out, you can see that it's just all choked with cars between the firehouse and the school. And the only way to
where
get
are
to
you?
The school, I'm in the second blue background image.
Well, you know, that image is full of... Is that supposed to be trees? That looks like it's full of a big cloud of dust.
Yeah, that's a little forested area.
Oh, I see. So that's the school. Yeah, and
school
well, that's
in the upper
all
right.
Clogged. It's all clogged, but there's not much in the parking lot.
Right.
The road to there is all clogged up, but there's not much in the parking lot.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Now, this going back to this pink picture, geez, we're running out of time already. This pink picture... those are long shadows. That's like 8 a.m. on a sunny morning or something, isn't it?
It feels early.
Oh, it is. You don't have shadows like that at 11 o'clock.
Well, you might in the middle of winter, though.
Really?
I don't know.
The others don't look like that.
Well, you see the same length shadows on all the images from the helicopter footage.
Well, yeah, this one here. At the firehouse, they're pretty long. These do look awfully long here. Super long, though.
Yeah.
Longer.
But in any case, it's close enough to the time of the incident that there should still be a lot going on.
Yeah.
I mean, if you listen to the radio, you know, at 11 o'clock, they say that they're doing a secondary sweep. The medics are checking for casualties. At 11:08, it says, try to get a count of students in the classroom, gathering names of students.
Well, if this happened at 9:30 and it was over in 10-15 minutes or something, 15-20 minutes, well, then they were all there, you know, coming along. What were they still doing at 11 o'clock? You know, there's no, of course, again, another thing is that there's no pictures of these students being removed from the school.
Right.
Evacuated.
Evacuated,
yeah. You just have this one picture of this group, which supposedly some people say was taken at a drill, several months earlier.
Yeah, I have that one all the way at the bottom.
Boy, you've got a lot of stuff here. Yeah, this is great. Oh, yeah, that one was all at the bottom. Yeah, and this doesn't look like December either, unless they were taken out without putting their coats on. But
some of those kids are laughing, you know. It's not like it's, you know, they're just, you know.
Well, are they laughing or crying? They're supposed to be crying.
Well, the ones in that back room look to me like they're laughing, you know. That girl in the blue, I don't know what she's doing.
She's crying.
Yeah, maybe. But, she could be.
But this could be the same day that this one above.
Right.
And this picture above is not December 14th. This
was earlier at school,
you know, practice where they practice. They do this stuff all the time. Fire drills. It used to be fire drills. Now it's a terrorism drill or something. And they, and look at the women have their coats on. So it's probably fall. And the kids, some of the kids have, you know, the kids here have their jackets on. All right. Well, I don't know.
They're dressed about the same in both pictures.
Yeah, these kids don't have their jackets on in this bottom picture. Okay, well, let's go back to all the way up here to this before the going in this door and out that door, where I really love these pictures of the two ambulances with the doors open and all these stretchers laid out and these people, medical aides standing around waiting. And I thought this was a picture from Sandy Hook, and I wondered why these people were dressed in shorts.
Oh, all the way at the top.
Yeah, all the way to the top. Yeah, all the way under the Know the Lies WordPress. Oh, that's an alternative. And then you pointed out to me that you had this other picture of the same scene, and it was by the water. It wasn't at Sandy Hook at all. Did you find out if this had ever been identified by any news organization as Sandy, as a picture of at Sandy Hook?
Well, the only use of it that I could find is was on a web page, and I just pasted it in a screen grab, and that's what's right up above, that knowthelies.wordpress.
Yeah.
So I found that in another, you know, just some blog sites where that picture had been used. I didn't find that image used by any of the network reporting, though.
Okay. Well, I saw it on Clues Forum. And
we've all seen it.
Yeah, but I don't know how, if somebody found it somewhere or how it was used. So we can't really, you know, we can't accuse things that we don't have the evidence.
Yeah.
But anyway, if anybody has seen that, they can know that was a totally different situation. And you said it was from when a boat sunk or something, a yacht sunk, and they were waiting for the survivors to be brought in.
Right.
And,
So you
have to be very careful of what you're looking at, and that's the whole thing, is that...
Yeah, images make a very fast impression.
Yeah.
All it takes is just a quick impression, like the one up above, seeing those guys running across the parking lot. I mean, that's all you need to know. Oh, there's an emergency. Something terrible's happened. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, and they use it with Sandy Hook. And said it was... They use it with the Sandy Hook story, and they use Sandy Hook... text there about the school principal and psychologist among the dead and so on. And then, you know, it was shown by some intelligent person how it was another school. So that's one real good example. But the thing that we need to point out is that we're living in an age here, more and more, where they can manufacture news, and to think that they're not manufacturing things, that everything has to be something that actually happened, and they're just using it, you know, they're using it for their own purposes. That's naive. And it doesn't fit what we know. And I think that, when people talk about all these, the way they've shown the parents, the Sandy Hook parents, only a few of them really get attention. And the way it's so often certain news people who are doing all the interviewing, and so on, that they just set this up. And then we have the you don't have it on here, but, Anderson Cooper's disappearing nose.
Right.
I saw really close up, on a couple of videos that were using that and proving that then there's Adam Lanza's eyes too, proving that they use this blue background
blue
thing. Yeah, blue screen stuff with Photoshop. And they just put people in different backgrounds, and they have them talking to someone who they're not really talking to. you know, that they take all this from different footage, and then they put it together, and it looks real, except if you're an expert, you can see telltale signs of this. And this was very distinct, that at some point, Anderson Cooper was in profile, and then his nose got cut off, and there was some kind of light blue plane color there.
And, he was apparently in the studio, and they simulated the, you know, they tried to make it look like he was actually interviewing her live when he was actually doing it from a studio somewhere.
Well, yeah, maybe she was there.
Yeah,
and the background was, you know,
and they just faked him in. I mean, that, you know, that doesn't necessarily prove that she was lying.
But you know, it's deceitful still. I mean, people think they're, why do they do that? Is this show business? I mean, they can't show the two of them talking in the studio. They have to show them outdoors on a night, you know, and how many others have been done that way? What about the Soto family? All this great stuff they've show about these people.
Or the Phelps. Did you see that? I've got the image of the Phelps. If you scroll down near the bottom, just up from the outdoor shots in the parking lot.
Let's see. Which ones now? Up from the bottom. The guy with the red hair. Oh, the Phelps people. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So online, there's all these websites showing all these other pictures of that couple not being the Phelps.
Well, yeah, I saw that too. People say, oh, they're not the same people. They sure look like the same people to me.
There's pictures all over the internet of them not being the Phelps.
Right.
And then the weird thing is that picture just below it, the woman that's supposedly the attorney for James Holmes, from all appearances, looks to be the same woman.
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't think
so? There's a similarity to a lot of people's looks.
Yeah, well.
But I wouldn't say that definitely, but these other pictures of this couple, and they say, oh, they just look the same, it's not the same people. I think they're the same people.
Oh, they're definitely the same, yeah.
Yeah, and they live in Florida, and here they are up here in Newtown doing this.
Yeah.
So these are a couple who does acting.
Right.
But I think, you want to say some? We've only got a few more minutes. Do you want to say some more about your pictures here?
Well, the other one that's interesting that came up just recently are these two night shots.
Yeah.
Because nobody's ever seen any bodies. Nobody's ever seen any actual evidence that there were any bodies in the building, anybody killed in the building or anything. So these two night shots popped up.
Well, they've been there for a while. I saw them on Clues Forum. And people thought they didn't look, they looked photoshopped. And they were saying all the reasons why.
Right.
And
so like that first one has a stop sign in it.
Yeah.
And then if you go down to the one, the picture three down from that where there's the arrow.
Yeah, there's no stop sign.
That would have to be the angle of view to create the picture, to create those two pictures. That arrow.
Oh, I see the arrow one. Okay.
Right. If you see at the tip of the arrow, there's those broad white stripes.
Uh-huh.
And the picture just above, the people are standing on broad white stripes.
Oh, yeah.
So from aerial shots of the parking lot, those broad white stripes only happen in two places. So that has to be where the angle of that shot was taken from. And you can see the side of the building in the background there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking over those broad white stripes, you would see the building. You know, if your line of sight is following that arrow.
Yeah.
You would more or less plausibly see something that looks like that.
So what does that mean, that they just invented this?
But there's no stop sign.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's no stop sign there, yeah.
There's no stop sign. And there's also some other odd peculiarities. Like in the second night shot, there's that light sitting on the stand, that bright light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And there's a person then standing on the path right next to it.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like a woman within the jeans. So if you look at where her feet are on that stripe,
the one with her back to us.
Right, she's lined up with that light. But she's not casting any shadow to the right.
Well, there is a shadow to the...
The shadow's falling away from her.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's no shadow falling down to the right.
Yeah.
Either from her or the person to her right.
That's right.
Which there should be with that super bright light right next to them, to their left.
Well,
it's not behind
the bright
them.
Light looks like it's facing us. It looks like it's facing the photographer. So maybe it wouldn't be shining on them so much. That's all I. But yeah,
yeah,
there's all kinds of telltale stuff with these, with the way the shadows are. Even in Holocaust pictures.
Yeah,
I mean, you have to look
other,
at all of that, and they just don't take care of all these little details.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's a lot of peculiarities in both of those pictures that don't really make sense if you try and figure out how they could have been taken. Plus the fact that whoever took it is looking through the trees. So to be in a position where you'd be looking through trees, you'd have to be clear out beyond the parking lot, back up on that hill somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to tell the listeners that you're going to be back on Monday. Oh, we're back further. I wasn't able to talk about. You need to look at Adam Lanz's eyes in these pictures where they've got his eyes so big and white all around his irises and so on. That's all been photoshopped. And there is a website that you can read about that. Let's see. I can't get to where the URL for that is. Anyway, that picture of him, the black and white picture, which sometimes you see in color with that long square chin.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a chin like that. If you go and find these better pictures, wherever the heck they are. Okay. No, I don't know where they are.
Well, I'll be adding to this post.
This page,
It's kind of a work in progress. I can include some of that.
Well, good, good. So people need to go there. All right, thank you very much.
ran
out of time so fast. Thank you, Harlan. And
always more to talk about. Okay.
We'll see you on Monday night.
Good to talk to you.
And the rest of you folks, too. Monday night at the Heritage Hour. Come back.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.